man. There's a beverage here, huh?
Does anybody here know how many times I've had to watch Funny Lady?
I'm gonna get that gun of mine, and I'm gonna change you from a rooster to a hen with one shot.
Welcome to another episode of Who Shot Ya? It's your boy, If You Whitey Way, and in the studio with me are my friends, the Virtual Who Studio, because, of course, we're still in a pandemic. Panorama, Pan's Labyrinth, Ponderosa Twins. First friend I'm going to introduce you to is none other than the illustrious, some say the best critic known to man, and that is Alonzo Duralde. What's good?
No one says that, Iffy, but that's very sweet of you. What's good for me this week is, now, I believe I have previously on the show plugged the Amber Ruffin show on Peacock, which I'm a big fan of. I think she's just hilarious and has just really been nailing it. Even, you know, like creating a talk show without a studio audience is no mean feat, but she's pulled it off. She and her sister, Lacey Lamar, have just co-written a book called You'll Never Believe What Happened to Lacey, Crazy Stories About Racism. And they are indeed crazy stories about racism. And this book is really funny and also very cringy in all the ways that it intends to be cringy. And I'm sure that it is a book that, black people and not black people can read and get a lot out of, but maybe not the same thing, and will maybe walk away with different things. I'm sure for black people, at least the way that Lacey and Amber narrate it, will walk away with a lot of recognition and nodding. And white people will be like, oh, shit. What did I do? What did I say? How have I messed this up? So I think it's a learning experience for me as a white person. It's a funny book, whoever you are, but I'm getting a lot out of it and really enjoying it. So I very highly recommend you check it out.
Yes, yes. That is a great book. And, you know, I have funny stories of racism. You can hear them. I drop them throughout the episodes. So, you know, if you like those, you'll probably love the book because it's probably way better worded and they are way funnier than me. I love Amber. She's the best. Next up, we have the Queen of the Midwest. You know, though she may have been away for a while, her reign still exists. It's Drea Clark. Drea, what's good?
Thank you. As ever, I'd like to make sure people understand that my monarchy also recognizes many other queens. So long may we reign. So you guys know I'm a company man, which means I'm definitely going to be bringing up the Sundance Film Festival right now. The day that this comes out, Sundance started yesterday, so it's running January 28th through February 3rd. The major passes are sold, but this is a whole new year for us for so many reasons, and it's the first time the festival has had virtual and a presence in different cities. So virtually, I recommend there's an Explorer's Pass that's only $25 that gets you throughout the duration of the festival access to all of the shorts, the Indie Series, which is a program that I do, New Frontiers, which is VR and all sorts of other things, and you don't need special stuff for all of it. So I highly recommend using that. You can also access the like virtual lounge where other filmmakers and festival goers, and then all the talks are free and there's so much great programming. So if you have been someone who has never even considered going, this is a great year to check it out. Also, go to their website because there's cities throughout the U.S. that are doing either in person or that you can do sponsored stuff with the theaters and like the film centers in your community. And so it's got just a very, anyway, Sundance, please be a part of it if you can. You know, my top 10 from next year is going to be 70%
Sundance. Get in on it early
anyway.
Now.
Yeah. Exactly.
I have a lot of movies to watch and write about this week, but I'm hoping to also be able to squeeze into some of the talks. They're doing the reviving the new queer cinema panel that yes. B. Ruby Rich did back in the day, and she's moderating again. But it's a mix of, you know, the veterans like Greg Araki, but newer folks like Andrew Ahn, and like Dre was saying, theaters that I love around the country, like the Plaza Theater in Atlanta and the Texas Theater in Dallas and the Bell Court in Nashville, are all sponsoring different panels and programs. I've heard the words virtual karaoke thrown around. I don't know what that's about. I'm going to let Jen Yamato explain it to me. But
get in that lounge.
Yeah.
No, it's good stuff. Check it out. Can't wait to see everybody there, but not really, but yes.
Yes, yes. And last up, we have an esteemed guest, co-host of Maximum Fun's Greatest Generation and Greatest Discovery, and known to be greatest of our generation, Benjamin Harrison. What's good?
Oh, man. Thank you guys for having me. Let's see. Well, big news from the podcast front is that we are just about to wrap up our reviews of Deep Space Nine and Ooh. Move on to Star Trek Voyager. So Ooh. We just recorded the last episode of reviewing an episode of Deep Space Nine. We always do like an entire series wrap up and a couple of other things in between series, but this will be the second full series of Star Trek that we've reviewed for the show. And it feels like, I don't know, it's like a moment that is both exciting and proud, because it's like, man, we like did all of that. That was like 176 episodes of television that we reviewed. Yeah. But also slightly embarrassing because it's a Star Trek podcast, and nerve-wracking because I'm like, do people care about Star Trek Voyager? Will they stick with us? Who knows?
One step closer to Enterprise, I think, is what you're really trying to say.
Right. Yeah. Well, it's been a long way getting from there to here. So
yeah. Ooh, yeah. No, that's a it sounds like a fun ride, and I would argue that people care too much about Star Trek.
How dare you.
Have you gotten something wrong on your pod yet? You'll find out.
Yeah. We find out every week about the things we get wrong.
Yeah. As someone who hosted a nerdy podcast, I'm like, that's the one thing. I love y'all, but boy, do y'all love correcting people.
We get out in front of it by just, emphasizing the fact that we do zero research for the show. It's not that kind of show, you know?
Captain Janeway rocks.
Yeah, she rules. So that's what's going on here. And also, I guess in movie news, we always make a little video for the listeners of us smashing some big Lego kits. Mm-hmm. And you guys can see in the background of my Zoom here that the camera is set up and the Lego kit is getting assembled. I just started filming my stuff for our big Lego smash, and really excited about that. It's a big fun project.
Ooh. I want to watch that. I like to watch things being built and then destroyed.
Yeah.
That's my sweet spot. Yeah. Speaking of seeing things in Zooms, before I ask Iffy what's good, I would like the world to know he has decided to try and usurp my place as the blonde in the crew, and like has these like long blonde braids. I mean, you look adorable.
Luxurious,
of course.
I think we would say.
Yeah.
It is. Yeah, I was real hyped. I wanted to switch things up because that's what I've been telling people is whenever if you have a style or a thing you've been like, I don't know, I'd love to try it, but it's like in the butts. We're in quarantine. If
in
it's
the
not
butts,
good, guess
indeed.
What? No one's really gonna see you. Yeah.
Well, what's good, Iffy, beyond your flowing locks?
What's good with me to keep it in tune for the digital festivals that we've been talking about? Both Sundance coming up. Normally around this time this year, I'd be up in San Francisco getting the yuck yucks going with San Francisco Sketch Fest. But this year they're doing a digital fest called Festpocalypse. And this Saturday, January 30th at 5 p.m., you can buy tickets. White Women, we submitted a sketch. It's really funny. You should check it out. It's a good time. So, get your laughs on and then watch a real dramatic Sundance film and get your cry on so you can hit all spectrums of your emotion. I think that's the way to do it.
And remind yourself you're not dead inside yet.
Exactly. Oh, see, Alonzo gets it! Well, speaking of a spectrum of emotions, today we're going to be discussing another round, where you feel all the emotions. You happy, sad, horny for Mads Mikkelsen. It's all the gamuts of emotions. But of course, we're also going to do the Who Shot Line Call and our staff picks. But first, it's time for our news segment, Itadic, short for Is This Important? Do I Care? Each of us will read a news segment and answer the question, Is This Important? Do I Care? And first up, we're talking about Soul's global release being dubbed by white actors. We recently discussed Pixar's film Soul on this very show about a black jazz musician named Joe, voiced by Jamie Foxx. But in the international release of the film, Joe is frequently voiced by a white actor. In Denmark, Germany, and Portugal, Joe is voiced by a white actor. The Danish actor Lee Kass, who voices Joe for the Danish release, had this to say about the controversy. "My position with regards to any job is very simple. Let the man or woman who can perform the work, but here we go, the best possible way, get the job." Blanket excuses.
That's a real patting himself on the back. Kind of defense.
I wonder if they just copy and paste it from the last press release that happened. The casting has prompted several petitions calling for the replacement of white actors who voiced Joe, and Danish activist Asta Salone Sekamane had this to say about the casting. "No one can claim there wasn't enough black talent to fill the main roles because actors of color were hired to voice some of the minor parts. It can't be the constant excuse, this idea we can't find people who live up to our standards. That's an invisible bar that ties the qualification to whiteness." Oh, couldn't have said it better myself. In fact, I may have said it 5 or 6 times in previous situations that use the same excuse. Shout out to Asta for that dope line. But is this important? Do you care?
Well, yeah. I'm stunned that we're having this conversation in 2021. It's like, it's not like we're talking about, like, these are, you know, this is Inside Out or something where we're talking about characters that are just like gleeps and glorps. This is a black man, a character who is a black man, which is a specific kind of person. And like, to have a white guy's voice, you know, coming out of that character's mouth just seems bonkers.
They also, the Pixar team went to such lengths to make sure there was an authenticity both to Joe's portrayal, but the animation of all of the black characters, the setting up of the world. Like, we talked about that with Jamal Bowie when we covered this film, but it wasn't, you know, there was such an effort made that this wouldn't be this token thing. And it was so important that it was the first time a Pixar film had a central character that was black. And it isn't hard. And it's also, it's a Pixar film. It's not like, you know, they do, there's a bunch of nonsense when you're putting together a package as a producer and like, oh, I need a name to sell this film, or, you know, only certain actors sell in foreign markets, but it's a Pixar film. There's a talking cat. Like,
there's only one name above the line,
right? Like, it's Pixar's Soul. It's not, whatever, Lee Kass's Soul. So, like, it's there's no excuse at all for it. And to Iffy and Asta's point, Iffy and Asta taking it on the road 2022. There is. It's such a standard excuse of when you resort back to that thing of like, well, it's a meritocracy. And, people just earn things. And the people, be it gender, racial, religion, whatever, who have been on like the low end of that to like maintain some nonsense status quo, it's ugly. And like, this is art. And boo, Denmark.
Boo. Yeah. I have a question. Does Pixar make this decision, or is it like foreign distributors that are doing this? Like,
I mean, is Disney. I can't imagine that they're like letting it go into anybody else's hands. I'm sure they're all, you know, they the mouse's glove prints are on it wherever it goes in the world. So yeah,
it seems like they should really be aware of these issues. Like, this has been litigated so many times about Disney films.
Yeah. All right. So moving on. I don't do segues. I'm no Iffy Waterway. So let's jump into.
Not everyone's the king of segues. No, you know? Listen, I might as well get a free segue.
Have our things. You have segues, and then I have making fun of you about segues. So, all right. So this past week, actress Keira Knightley said on the podcast Chanel Connects that she will no longer be shooting sex scenes in movies directed by men. Knightley said that it's, quote, partly vanity and also the male gaze. She also said, quote, "I don't have an absolute ban, but I kind of do with men. I'd just rather not stand in front of a group of men naked." She also cites, quote, "changing desires about her body as she grows older," end quote, as a reason why she will no longer be in sex scenes directed by men. Is this important? Do you care?
I think she has absolutely that right to make that decision. And yeah. if it's a thing where she feels like she's been burned before, or she just doesn't trust, how it's going to be handled, then yeah, I mean, she's got clout and she is exercising it.
Yeah, yeah, that was what stood out to me about this, that, you know, there's so much at every level. I feel like there's fear in many actresses of, even if there's someone, Keira Knightley, like Academy Award nominated, huge box office, like big star for a very long time now. And yet there's still a trepidation of, ugh, am I going to do things that make me unpalatable, that people won't want to hire me or whatever. So to be flexing in the other way of, no, I feel comfortable in my career and also as what I feel comfortable with as a woman. And these are things that come to mind. But it's also, to me, important of, you don't often, average moviegoers or viewers aren't giving a lot of thought to the behind the scenes of what goes into sex scenes or what goes into, we talk about the male gaze and what that can mean critically, but the idea of how that can translate on a set and how that's similar to workplace environments of uncomfortable, like, gender, either disparity or power or whatever. And I think that she just brought it up in a podcast, a Chanel podcast. So it's not like it was this big, oh, listen to my statement, but it's this coming from a point and drawing attention to something of, yeah, you've watched all my movies. Now, please know, a lot of those were uncomfortable to me, and I'm always standing around naked in front of all of these crew people who are normally male. And what does that mean? And I think if we're bridging that veil between celebrity and people as much as we do, that bringing up realities like this with them as well is nice.
I'd be curious to hear, like, her take on, you know, intimacy coordinators and if she's ever worked with one. I know that's still a relatively recent phenomenon in the biz.
Yeah.
I think someone as big as her kind of making this statement will hopefully make the industry as a whole rethink the male gaze and how, you know, women are shot in these scenes.
There's a big difference too. Alonso. With, of course, exceptions of various artistries, but if you watch love scenes shot by women and shot by men, I mean, even when we talked about the first Wonder Woman, those aren't even love scenes, just like how Wonder Woman is shot in her short fighting battle outfit versus how she's shot by a man in Justice League. Like, then you add, like, sex and nudity to it, and it's a whole different thing.
Indeed. Also, somebody we dig is Anne Hathaway. I know she said on Kimmel, one of those shows, or The Tonight Show, call me, like, she wants to go by Annie. I feel weird about that. So she's
Annie Haths. No, come on, I'll do it.
You're still Anne Hathaway to me. Anyway, much like the host of the Who Shot You podcast, Anne Hathaway is fueled by her haters. After she won an Oscar 8 years ago for Les Miserables, there was a huge backlash against her. Hathaway even cites finding an article titled, "Why Does Everyone Hate Anne Hathaway?" But in a recent interview with The Sun, Hathaway said the hatred towards her ended up being a good thing. Quote, "I really don't want to dredge up the past, but I did have my monster out there. I did have the internet turn on me and hate me, and it was like a whole big thing. And it was a really good thing for me personally. You can be incredibly empowered because of those things. So I guess what I'd say is, when the bad shit happens, don't fear it. Just go with it. Flow with it. Is this important? Do you care?"
Freaking, I love her even if she says things like, just go with it, flow with it. Like, I'm an Annie Hath number one defender, always will be. I do think, you know, we've talked before about, she has, like, such to the core earnest theater kid vibe. And, like,
drama club
you
energy.
Cannot get rid of her drama club energy. And yet she's an incredible performer. I do like this. I like that take on it of looking at running through the idea of being universally mocked. I couldn't handle what any of them go through, but hers is such a specific blend of, oh, you were mocked because you're just dorky as hell. And it's very easy to, and she cares so much. And I feel like that's something people can relate to in real life. Like how many times, maybe especially younger, but like that you see someone who's an object of ridicule entirely because of their sort of earnest, like, and it's even harder to watch. But I like the idea of anyone taking these sort of negative things being like, all right, also what's more Anne Hathaway than that? What positives can I make out of this, right?
Well, I love that she's channeling into the work. I mean, like, her performance in Ocean's 8 is so much a, like, brilliant self-own. Like, she is having fun with the public perception of what she's like and just sort of pushing that to a whole other place, and it's hysterically funny. I despised Les Mis and I did not particularly care for her performance in it, but beyond that, I'm generally a fan. I'm a huge supporter of Lockdown right now on HBO Max, which I guess is what she's out there promoting. But yeah, in general, I think she seems very savvy about what the public perception of her is, and also like savvy enough to understand that her need to give a shit about what her public perception is goes only so far.
Usually when people turn on you on the internet, like, it's either the good people or the bad people. And if it's the bad people turning on you on the internet, it's like, good.
Yeah, oh yeah.
No, less of you, great. Like, it's going to be really easy to figure out who to mute.
We're going to take a break, but when we come back, we'll be talking about another round.
All right, so once again, we are happy to have our buddies from Storyblocks supporting the podcast. Storyblocks is dedicated to being the world's best royalty-free stock media subscription service with an ever-growing library of stock assets, including music, images, sound effects, more, even more.
Now, I know some of you guys are like total whiz at, you know, editing and, you know, dragging and clicking and cutting and pasting, and I am not. I am an elder, and so much of technology just terrifies me. And you're thinking, you know what? I'm trying to make this professional looking video for my business, or I've got this event coming up, but I'm no Steven Spielberg. I can't make that happen. I don't know which button to push. Well, it turns out you don't have to be David Fincher to understand how this thing works. Storyblocks is super user-friendly. They will walk you through the process. They make it so easy that even somebody as inept as me could come out with a super glossy professional piece of work.
Ooh, yes. But let me tell you about all the reasons they're amazing. Look, they have affordable subscription plans and tools. And with Storyblocks Unlimited All Access Plan, you can get unlimited downloads of everything in their library. And even if your subscription ends, everything you've downloaded is yours to keep. In 2020, Storyblocks launched Restock, an initiative to increase diversity in their library. Storyblocks is committing to have 20% of their footage contain Black, Indigenous, and people of color by 2022, with plans to expand their scope to include more underrepresented groups in the future. And as someone who's needed Black people for stock images, this is a big, big thing. Big thing.
Ooh, yeah. That's my iffy move back in. Explore their library and subscribe today at storyblocks.com/whoshot. That's storyblocks.com/whoshot.
I'm going first. It's me, Jackie Cation.
Man, she's always this bossy. Hi. I'm Lori Kilmartin. We're a bunch of stand-up comics, and we've been doing comedy like 60 years total with both of us, but we look amazing.
And we're working out. We drop every Monday on Max Fun, and it's called The Jackie Lori Show, and you could listen to it and learn about comedy and learn about anger management and all the things.
And Jackie is married but childless, and I'm unmarried but child full. So together, we make one complete woman.
Is that just what that one's gonna end?
Yeah. And we try to make Kyle laugh just like that and say, oh my God, every episode.
It's a good job.
Jackie and Lori Show, Mondays, only on Maximum Fun.
Welcome back to Who Shot You? I'm your host, Evie Whiteaway. In the studio with me are...
Drea Clark.
Ben Harrison.
Alonzo Duralde.
And guess what we're talking about? We're talking about another round. So, Alonzo, why don't you provide us with a, in all caps from producer Casey, brief synopsis?
I'll do my best. So Mads Mikkelsen stars as a high school history teacher who is just kind of living in the gray zone. He's not doing his job very well. He's not really there for his wife. He's just kind of living in a fog. And at a friend's birthday party, four of them decide that they are going to pursue this theory from a Danish psychologist that everybody's blood alcohol level is a little too low and that we really all operate best if we have a slight buzz going on. So for science, they decide to give it a shot. And for a while, it seems to work. They all seem to be doing better in their jobs. They seem to be more present in their relationships. But of course, as these things go, it all ends in a terrible, catastrophic way. And it ends in a wonderfully... it's up to you to decide if this is a happy ending or not ending, but it is basically about four guys in a midlife crisis and why adding more alcohol to that doesn't necessarily make things better.
Shocking. It's interesting to hear it described like that because it's the kind of film, it was much more difficult to explain this film when I was thinking about it later than I thought it would be. Like when I heard the pitch of it or the tagline, like, oh, four middle-aged guys decide to try like day drinking, I was like, oh, this is either going to be like Todd Phillips or like just some like dark Cassavetes. Do you know what I mean? Like there's, and it's actually so tonally, it's tonally together. Like it knows what it is, but it's also much more all over the place than I was expecting. Like there's both more lightness and more introspection than
It's directed by Thomas Vinterberg, and if you've seen, like, you know, The Celebration or The Hunt, which is one of several films he's made with Mikkelsen, you know that he loves to, you know, zag when you think he's going to zig and kind of take audiences to really sort of uncomfortable places and make us question, like, am I rooting for anyone in this movie and why? And what do I want to have happen in this situation? So, yeah, I think it very much kind of, you know, it doesn't deliver either the sort of wacky comedy or the, oh, God, you know, alcoholism narrative you're going to get. And Andrea, I know that you talk a lot when we touch on movies that have what you have referred to as addiction narratives. And while that's present here, I don't know that that's necessarily, I wouldn't categorize this movie as one of those.
Yeah, no. Yeah, I've definitely bring that up before. Like if you've ever loved anyone who's an addict, had that in your life, like it's definitely something that pings to me every time it comes through in a film that we watch. And this one, I don't know if it's just because it's so effing European, but like the difference is this, I do not think this movie could be made as an American film.
Oh God, no, not in the same way. No.
Right? Because like just how they talk about drinking, and even when they do mention like, oh, well, we don't want to become alcoholics, it's such a different perspective there than it is here. And the fact that, you know, by the time you get to the end, so all four of these men work at a high school together, and so they're like dealing with seniors and they have this graduating class, and of course if your drinking limit is 18, it also changes like how that perspective is. Like these teachers are casually talking to their students about the drinking, their high school students about the drinking they're doing. So yeah, it did not have the same sort of, oh, this is going to be a rough one for me to watch, that you would think a movie about four men actively seeking to become daytime alcoholics would.
The weird thing wasn't that they were drinking, but that they were drinking at work. Like that was the energy that it felt, where it's like, oh no, it's not, we're drinking at work. Okay. All right. We'll just see how it is. And as a comedian, I'm like, that's my job.
Nice.
I thought it was interesting that the guy that did wind up dying from being an alcoholic in the end had kind of all of the like things that you look for in an alcoholic very early on too. Like he was like hiding booze in stupid places. And like, I don't know, like there's plenty of people in my immediate family and broader family who have dealt with addiction issues. And I'm very familiar with some of those dynamics. And I, I really agree that like the European lens on it is super different, but also just like the kind of monoculture of like, oh, like it's Denmark. Everybody does like Denmark type stuff here.
And right.
So what we all know what racing around the lake while drinking a case of beer looks like.
Right? Isn't that why lakes exist? Yeah.
This was a very breadcrumby movie where they'll say a thing and don't sit too much on it and then it'll come back. Mm. Like very much so at the very beginning the catalyst of this is when they're at a birthday dinner and they find out that Martin, Mads Mikkelsen's character, he's kind of feels like he's in a rut with his wife and his life. And the first thing they mention was like, well, you think she's cheating? And they just move past it. It's never addressed. And I think also too, you have like that short moment with the friend Tommy who ends up dying, where it's like, he's like, man, I don't have kids and I don't have like you see this like darkness in them and then they move past it but right. then it comes back later on. And that was really interesting because I think you get that when you watch movies outside of you know, American films, because I think there's ways that different cultures like to tell stories. And it's like, we don't have to rest on this because we said it. So when it comes back, you'll know that we said it earlier.
Yeah, it's not that Back to the Future thing of like, we are setting up this thing later. It's going to be important later. So everybody make sure you're looking at this thing right now.
Did everybody hear me say how many gigawatts I need?
Yeah.
It's interesting that you say that part felt, because there is a European narrative to that, to do a much lighter breadcrumb dropping. But I also found what was ultimately the most interesting thing to me about this movie is as a group, as a podcast, we are particularly drawn to films from more of an outsider perspective that are more like, oh, what are the women or the queer? Do you know, like, and this is just set firmly in like, oh no, this is a story about middle-aged white men who are like comfortable with their money. And I come from a long line of such people, so I'm not like totally disparaging of that, but it is something that as we're like embracing different perspectives, that's one that is like considered less accessible. And to me, to see this and have it really take a new angle and interesting angle in on these men's lives and like what this film is really about is, this is, speaking of the Greatest Generation, a different generation of men raised with no tools for emotional intelligence, no way to really speak, even in a comfortable environment with the four of them. When they're in a place to be vulnerable, they don't have the language to explain what they're going through. They don't have that language with their partners at home. They have, and it's ground them down. And, you know, it's like the catalyst of this being something as ridiculous seeming as, you know what's going to change it? Daily alcohol. Like, that they're holding up, like he's a history teacher and he starts talking about like, the minute anybody brings up Hemingway as like something to aspire to, I'm like, oh, that's funny. But it was very interesting to me that this whole like gimmick of this drinking premise was really about, oh, these men need something to be able to be full humans because it was not bred into them. It was not taught to them. It was not encouraged of them. And that to me was so fascinating. So yes.
Is there a term for like, I don't, like coming of age story, but for middle age? Cause that's kind of what it felt like. They like they're like connecting with an idea of how to be in the world that they didn't grow up with. And it felt very much like a Buildings Roman or whatever.
Yeah, we'll accept coming of middle age. Yeah.
Okay.
Buildings Roman is good too, though.
Yeah.
I turned to my wife while we were watching this, and I said, "Like these guys are 40. Like I'm on my way. Brace yourself.
You have this to look forward to."
Yeah.
This is what all
straight white men do.
Universally, when talking about the what makes this movie sort of, you know, different from the way that, like, a Hollywood movie would have done it, I love the subtle turns in things like Mads Mikkelsen you know, is a movie star, and he is a charismatic, handsome movie star, and he manages to go from making himself be like kind of frumpy and, you know, beaten down by life to alive for the first time, you know, to then like where it goes from there. In the subtlest of ways, like there's no wig, there's no like really bad hairdo, you know, or like the like shit clothes or whatever. Like he just, it's just it's subtle touches in posture and demeanor and things. And in the same way, the cinematography, I think, really kind of like when they're on a good buzz, like one of them coaches this terrible kids soccer team. And suddenly it's like we're watching ESPN. It's like this golden dapple hued, you know, thing of the majesty of sport, you know, and whereas it had been just like overcast, you know, before then. So
right.
Just little touches like that along the way. The movie isn't informing you of things, but if you're paying attention, it's giving you everything that you need to follow these guys through this very strange and tragic experiment.
Did you guys read that there were two things that really surprised me reading about the production of this movie? One is that the director's daughter died in a car accident like days into the beginning of principal photography.
She was meant to play Mads's daughter in it. They ended up reshaping a lot of the story. Yeah.
And I think I was just like skimming Wikipedia when I read that, and I initially read it as drunk driving accident, and then I was like, wow, like I can't believe you continue even working on this after something like that. But I think it was not that.
Yeah.
But also like totally amazing to like finish a film after enduring a tragedy of that kind. But also the four main characters and the director drank on set like to kind of like do what they were portraying. Like this is not method acting.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Or it's like too much method acting.
Is that what it is?
It's an experiment.
Yeah.
You know, we're seeing if it works for us, y'all. Don't worry.
Cuz like acting drunk is really hard. It's really hard to like sell that like that like looseness and stuff, and like I was a PA like very early in my movies career on an indie film where the lead actress had to act drunk and did a terrible job, and it like almost made me quit the business. It was so bad.
Oh, this is how terrible you are. I'm leaving the field.
Yeah. You got me. You
see
got
if
me
I can get in the plumbers union or something. I don't know. Yeah.
One last thing I want to throw out real quick is that, you know, while this is, as Dre pointed out, very much a white dude movie, the character of Mads Mikkelsen's wife, who's played by Maria Bonvi, gets a couple of really churse scenes, I think. One where she is like completely just sort of laying out all the things that are wrong with their marriage, and then one later where they're in a public restaurant and he's sort of trying to reconcile and she is not having it.
I'm so glad you brought that up. No, both she there's two spouses in this. There's Mads Mikkelsen's wife, who has been more and more distanced, and well, he's been more and more distanced, and she's reacted thusly, and then one of the other characters, who has this beautiful wealthy wife and three very small children that are always on her or holding on to her, and
if they're not on her, they're peeing on him.
Or both. And I thought both of the women were used very well, especially countered to this idea of emotional maturity or the lack thereof, and the idea of what these women were having to do to hold their households together, that like the men who were probably loving and willing spouses but not intuiting the ways that they should be picking up the slack, or that they were dropping the ball, or doing some other metaphor that sounds slightly sports related. And I thought it was just I'm so glad you brought that up, because both of those female characters bring it into such sharp relief how these men are like falling short.
Exactly. And how unfair it is that they get to just like test a crazy idea with their lives and families when their wives are just like trying as hard as they can to put one foot in front of the other.
Right. All right. Vote.
Yeah, I was just about to say it's time for that vote. As our guest, Benjamin, the way we vote things around here is, would you, the top being, would you snap it up on physical media? Next okay. down, stream it. And then after that, it's skip it.
I would definitely stream it. But I'm not really a physical media guy, so that's a I'm gonna go like halfway between snap it and stream it because like it's always stream it for me.
Okay. Okay, I feel that. What about you, Drea?
This is interesting. So much of this I was appreciative, I was enjoying, but I was at a kind of stream it level. The last 10 minutes of this movie I found so transcendent. Mm. That they elevate it. Like, if you know anything about Mads Mikkelsen, he does have a dancer background. Like, he started as a dancer. And okay. if you've just heard our entire discussion and wonder why in the hell that would factor in, then yes, I definitely encourage you to check it out and see why. And yeah, the energy and the feeling of that final, like, I left this and was like, whoa. Yeah. And then I wanted to go drink with strangers, so you know.
Yeah.
Instead, big like Christopher Walken energy.
Yeah.
Oh yes. Oh my gosh. They should do a buddy movie. Anyway, so I became a snap it up on physical media.
Wow.
Yeah.
All right. And Alonzo.
Yeah, I'm for sure a snap it up. I think this movie's really great. I think it's a really strong ensemble, but yeah, Mads Mikkelsen is just sort of next level here.
So gorgeous.
I'm a big Vinterberg fan. I've actually taught the Celebration before when I've taught film classes and I just think there's so much to sort of dig into here and so many great ideas. It's actually co-written, by the way, by Vinterberg and Tobias Lindholm, who is a filmmaker in his own right. He did A War and some other stuff. Just to rewatch that ending, even if nothing else, you know, I would certainly want to have it in the library.
Yeah, I am also a snap it up, and I think a strong second to both things said. One, yes, Mads was looking like I was like staring at him, and I know it wasn't the point, but like when she didn't want him back, I'm like, Mads, you good, man?
Right?
You good? I was just like, taking that. You good?
Over. Excuse me, ma'am. Can I take your seat? Yes.
You like going to bars? You'll meet somebody.
Yeah. But yeah, the dancing was really great and beautiful too. And now I didn't know that he had a dancing background, but now it makes sense because they really made a meal out of it. And I was like, this feels like a writer scene. Like this feels like a scene that was like, okay, I'm gonna do your film, but here's how it's gonna end. But it really does have significance because of, you know, this was a huge foreshadowing. And
yeah, they tampered down the whole time. The one outlet that he had to creative expression was so routinely mocked by his friends that he like shelved it away. Okay, yeah, whatever.
And then he had the injury, so he couldn't do it as much. And I in my head, that's when the marriage stuff started happening. So it just was really like him coming. It's beautiful. And I'm gonna snap it up on physical media as soon as I can. Criterion, get on it. All right, get it. I need a fancy cover. But we're gonna do a fancy segue because we'll be right back after we hear from another show from Maximum Fun.
All right, Adam, Maximum Fun wants us to record like a promo to tell people that they should listen to The Greatest Generation. You want to do that?
No, I am tired of all the extra work. I just wanted to talk about Star Trek with my friend.
I think it would be good to like try and get some new listeners by appealing to the audiences of other shows. Like this will only take a minute or two. It could be good for us.
We sit down for an hour every week and talk about a Star Trek episode and make a bunch of idiotic fart jokes about it. It's embarrassing. If it got out that we made this show, I think it would make us unemployable.
Adam, I have bad news for you. We have tens of thousands of listeners at MaximumFun.org.
Oh my god. I think I'm gonna throw up.
The Greatest Generation, a Star Trek podcast by a couple of guys who are a little bit embarrassed to have a Star Trek podcast. Every Monday on MaximumFun.org.
I'm really gonna be sick.
Welcome back to Who Shot Ya? I'm your host, Ify Wadiway, and in the studio with me are
Alonzo Duralde,
Ben Harrison,
Drea Clark.
It's the return of the Who Shot Line. Well, let's answer a call from one of our listeners. Casey, play that call.
Hey, everyone. My name is Arlen, and I use they, them pronouns. Because of the failures of the federal government, not to mention my state's government failures, I have been stuck in my one-bedroom apartment for about 6 months now, and I kind of want to be anywhere else. So I was wondering if you could suggest movies that have a great sense of the place they are set in, preferably places that feel expansive. Maybe something along the lines of the Trip movie. Thank you so much, and all my love to you. You bring me a lot of joy.
That was really
sweet. Thanks, Arlen. Yeah.
Arlen, I feel you. I'm in my one-bedroom apartment, too.
Yes.
Oh. Yes. I'm glad they mentioned The Trip, because I think I'd done a staff pick of the third one a month ago. What is time? I don't know. In the last year. But one of the things I loved about it was, oh yes, I feel like I'm on vacation. And movies that can do that and give you that broad sense of space are so nice all the time. Certainly so nice right now.
Actually IFC just put out a lovely box set with all four Trip movies in it. So
Well, I was gonna say today is the anniversary of the release of Before Sunrise, and you can sit through and listen to Ethan Hawke blabble at you as you explore these beautiful European cities while he just shouts at your face.
How dare you? We did a whole series on that. Blabble at you. You should be so lucky. One of the first things that came to mind, because it was a response I had to this film, was The Motorcycle Diaries. Gael Garcia Bernal. It's a Walter Salles. He's Brazilian director, and it's a young Che Guevara on what starts as a motorcycle ride, and then modes of transportation change, but all across South America. And a lot of it is what eventually shaped what became his sort of political ethos, but it's, you're in just different cultures and different regions and different areas, and a lot of it is travel and so beautiful and also very, very different, weirdly, from my apartment. It's a lot of scenery I don't get here in my home. Who knew?
I had a thought that's a documentary that had a really great sense of place. I just randomly watched this a few weeks ago with my wife. It's called My Octopus Teacher. It's on Netflix, and the premise is that the filmmaker just goes and like hangs out in this one part of the like a kelp forest off the coast of Cape Town in South Africa, and basically forms a trusting friendship with an octopus and goes every day. And I think in total he spent like 200 or 300 days just hanging out with this cool octo. And there's a lot of like drama because octopi live these very like, you know, they're like middle of the food chain creatures. So she's getting hunted, but she's also hunting, and like he's watching all of these like totally amazing things that octopi do. But like spending an hour and a half in a kelp forest off the coast of South Africa is a great way to spend some time. And it's a really remarkable nature documentary for a lot of reasons. I don't know if it's like a great, great, great film, but it's like I was so delighted to have just discovered it. It was like one of the rare, like stumble upon a movie on Netflix and have it just be like exactly what the doctor ordered kind of moments.
And it's gorgeous. The director, who's also the cinematographer, or one of the cinematographers, is a longtime nature DP, and like it looks so beautiful, and he's free diving. That's part of it. He doesn't want to have oxygen tanks, and there's a whole lot more sort of philosophical, existential sort of musings wound through it than you would expect. Yeah, it's a great call.
And he's also drunk like the entire time.
Just a little drunk.
Slightly elevating his blood alcohol level.
Yeah.
I am not crazy about the the Kenneth Branagh versions of these, at least the one that we've gotten in the trailer that I've seen for the next one, which seem very green screeny. But if you want like actual tactile in the place kind of stuff, I would recommend the old Agatha Christie mysteries, Murder on the Orient Express, Death on the Nile, and Evil Under the Sun, which take you to cool places while murders are happening. Murder on the Orient Express, they do, it's mostly stuck on a train in the snowy mountains, but that's kind of cool. And then Death on the Nile, you get to go down the Nile on a riverboat. And then Evil Under the Sun is set on this gorgeous hotel on the Adriatic somewhere. And The Last of Sheila, I'll throw that one in too.
They
go to the Riviera and you get to be on a yacht. So those are all, if you don't mind that someone is going to die. It's a great excuse to go to fun places.
Those are such a good call, Alonzo. Bonus Last of Sheila is going to give you, if you have a thing for men wearing very tight white pants, then this is the movie for you. Also, Unexpected Puppets.
Yes.
You really can't go wrong with The Last of Sheila. Yeah. Iffy?
I'm trying to think of other movies with like great locales.
I have a couple while you're thinking. Just spew them.
We'll do it. Do it.
I have a shame-free that I definitely rewatched during this pandemic. Under the Tuscan Sun with Diane Lane.
Ooh, gorgeous. Enchanted April. Same deal.
Oh, yes, exactly. Like, beautiful, like literally shot in Tuscany, looks gorgeous. If you've ever thought, I'd like to look like Diane Lane and restore a crumbling house in Tuscany, this is your chance. Also, Amelie is a fantastical side of Paris that you can't actually visit because Paris will not treat you like it does in Amelie. Nor will it look like that. But it's so beautiful and whimsical and wonderful.
I've been kicked out of so many grocery stores in Paris for putting my hand elbow deep in the lentils.
Yes. I'm always just walking around with those raspberries on my fingertips. Yeah, it's a problem.
I'm trying to remember, there's a Netflix series of, they're like nature documentaries for people who don't want to learn anything. Like there's no narration. It's just these gorgeous, like crazy fish and, desert plants and things. And it's like, it's very trippy and I like
you're
it
saying
very much.
Nature documentaries for high people.
Essentially, yes.
That's where visuals. I was going to cut in with the user experience. Because I like popping that on and then I'll get my record player and like throw on like some tunes and just sit back and enjoy nature and be like,
I wish they still had those slow TV things where it'd be like, you know, it's a 3-hour thing and it's all like shot out the window of a train going through Norway, you know, or like people knitting or whatever. They got rid of the slow TV. But if you look up slow TV, it'll take you to my high nature doc. So
there you go.
and you can discover that the dark side of the moon actually syncs up with everything.
Thank you so much, Arlen, for that wonderful question. And thank you to everyone who has called in. The number for the Who Shot line is WSY 803-1664. Be like Arlen. They drop in the good stuff. So only give good questions. Only give the good ones. All right. Now it's time for staff picks. It could be any movie at all. So Drea, why don't you start?
All right, so this is not a narrative, and it's not a documentary either, but man, it blew my mind, and it is Derek Del Gaudio's In and of Itself, which is currently on Hulu, directed by Frank Oz. Yes, that Frank Oz. I remember when this was a stage show in Los Angeles at the Geffen, and then it was in New York for a long time. He did it for like... it says at the top of it, 522 performances. It's basically an edited down theater performance. But it reminds me of, you know, some of what we talked about with Hamilton, because it's incredibly well produced and really well integrated. Really well integrates. Words are my tools. It does a beautiful job of conveying what the show is. And he is a storyteller and an incredible sleight of hand magician and an illusionist. And there's All I'll say is, please go into it blind. Please know that I was weeping through parts of this, that there's magic that made me cry, which seems so strange, but it's dealing with identity and so much that can't be described. So yes, Derek Delgadio's In and of Itself on Hulu.
Wow. All right. Benjamin, do you have one for us?
Sure. Bringing up Sundance earlier reminded me of a film I just watched recently on the Criterion Channel app, Barefoot in the Park. It's a 1967 rom-com with Robert Redford and Jane Fonda has always been at the height of her powers and will never stop being at the height of her powers, but this is like Nixon's enemy list, Jane Fonda, she is so great in it. I would say that it's really her movie, and Robert Redford is kind of in a supporting role almost, but they're like a young couple that moves into a crappy apartment in the West Village in the 60s, and Jane Fonda is like trying to set her mom up with the guy upstairs or something. And
played by Mildred Natwick and Charles Boyer, for people who care about these things.
Yeah. And it's like there is a little bit of like I guess period homophobia. There's like a couple of tossed off jokes that we didn't really care for when we were watching it here, but overall it's a really like, it's a delightful movie, and the rare movie about like people living in a crappy apartment in New York where the apartment actually seems crappy, because so many crappy apartments in New York in film and television are actually like amazing. As a person who lived in New York for 15 years, I've always coveted the crappy apartments people had, but this one was one where I was like, oh wow, that would actually suck to live in.
It's like an eighth floor walk up. It's Jane Fonda channeling Anne Margaret, so like you're in such good hands. But fun fact, we did the play Barefoot in the Park, and when I was a ninth grader, oh yeah, I played her mother, which is, again, we've discussed, I've only ever played and only ever will play the funny old woman, especially if she's crotchety, and that started very young.
Oh, yeah, and I should say it's based on a Neil Simon play, yeah. And he did the screenplay as well. And boy, it was really, really fun, and I miss New York. I think that if you're looking for a movie with a great sense of place, I'd say that Barefoot in the Park has that as well. It was a ton of fun.
Yeah, no, that one's a hoot. I would love to have seen how Elizabeth Ashley did that role on Broadway, but yeah, Jane Fonda's great stuff from her as always. And she's getting the DeMille Award from the Golden Globes this year, which I'm very excited about.
I can't wait.
Very well deserved. That's going to be a hell of a clip reel. So my stat pick this week, again, this is one of the reasons that I always bring up physical media stuff, is because movies just can disappear on you if you don't have your own copy. Case in point, Tom Noonan's What Happened Was. This is a movie that won the Best Screenplay Award and the Grand Jury Prize at the 1994 Sundance Film Festival. I reviewed it when it came out. Big fan of that film. And then it just went away. Like, it didn't, I don't know that it's ever been released on DVD before now. It didn't turn up in repertory. It was just gone. And now there is a new 4K restoration, and Oscilloscope has released it, and it's showing in virtual cinemas. So look for your favorite art house near you or not near you, and you can rent it from there. But Tom Noonan and Karen Silas star as two co-workers who meet at her apartment for dinner on a Friday night. And it starts out awkward and gets worse from there. But it is very intense and very claustrophobic, and has some really interesting shifts and turns, and you really don't know where this thing is going. And the two performances are extraordinary, and it made my husband very uncomfortable. And not a lot of movies do that, so it has a real power to it. So I'm thrilled after going on, 30 years now, that people now once again get a chance to discover or rediscover What Happened Was.
Nice.
Yeah, with me, this was a real interesting juggle. I try and do something based off the actor or theme. There weren't really any, like, you know, teachers letting loose movies that jumped out at me. Like, usually in America, there are a lot of comedies. So, you know, I had to go with a Mads, go to Mads movie, show some love to my man's Mads. And I didn't want to do him dirty with Doctor Strange, you know, even though he was amazing in that.
He's great in that.
But I do want to give, you know, and I'm going to die on this hill till the day I die. The Rogue One is good. Eat it, Star Wars nerds. And Mads is looking good in there. Also, you get Donnie Yen. I mean, it's a real snack fest. And it's an amazing movie as well. Rogue One, a Star Wars story, is my pick. And it'll get you ready because Disney Plus announced the series that's going to take place in that world. So
it's going to be set in the 2 minutes between them landing on the ship.
Yeah, something like that. So anything they can kind of put in that juicer, Star Wars juicer.
We're going to parse it out by the millisecond. Yeah.
We're gonna start talking to, like, the accountants on Bespin.
What was happening on D-Deck?
Yeah. Well, Ben, thank you so much for joining us. Anything you'd like to plug before we get out of here?
Oh, wow. Thank you so much for having me. Check out my podcasts. Also on Max Fun, I've got The Greatest Generation and The Greatest Discovery. And those are both Star Trek podcasts. And I may have some new projects coming out soon, but I don't really know if anything is, like, ready to announce. But those two are going strong and super fun if you like Star Trek or dick and fart jokes or a blend of the two.
And who doesn't, really?
That's a good pitch. Yeah.
Honestly, that's the real question. If you don't like it, what's your problem?
But it's been a joy to be here with you guys, and I'm so glad I got to watch that movie because I wouldn't have even heard of it if I hadn't gotten invited to review it with y'all.
Nice. Yeah.
Thanks for being here.
Yes. Yeah, truly. Andrea, Alonzo, thank you for another wonderful show. Any last remarks before we get out of here?
I've said enough.
I was going to say, I'm shutting up now.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, if you'd like to support the show, please visit MaximumFun.org/join. If you'd like to purchase a Jumbotron, go to MaximumFun.org/Jumbotron. It's $100 for a personal message or $200 for a promotional one. Again, the number for the Who Shot line is WSY-803-1664. And if you have a comment or suggestion about this week's show, tweet at us at Who Shot Your Pod. Our Facebook group can be found at www.facebook.com/groups/WhoShotYaPodcast, or send us an email at whoshotya@maximumfun.org. Our producer is Casey O'Brien, our senior producer is Laura Swisher, and this is a production of Maximum Fun.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned,
audience supported.